Would there be a group of churches or organizations that would be interested in seeing something come here? So just for example, we operated React for the last year and a half at $400 a day. Do you realize how much an Edgewood would cost to run a day? About $100,000 a day plus. So we were offering a program that was giving quality material and dealing with people over an extended period of time at a very, very fractional cost. So it was, there's a need, we know that, but what is a solution? Not just by you learning, but what then do you go out and do? So that we're going to talk about a bit tomorrow. Just a couple other things I want you to add to you, kind of things that contribute to complex trauma. What we know now is what is called vicarious complex trauma, and that's for people who are in the people helping business. So when I listen every day to people's trauma, it traumatizes me. And if I don't have good boundaries and learn how to rest and withdraw and detach, I will burn out, which I did at one point. And so it's become a very understood, important thing that people in churches and treatment centers and the social agencies that work with traumatized people get vicarious trauma. They need tools to learn how to deal with that. Next thing, a lot of people that I, not a lot, but some people that I deal with did have fairly good childhoods and not really a lot of trauma. But then let's say in their teens, they had a series of heavy duty losses or traumatic things, a car accident, friend commits suicide, parent die, sibling die, and all of a sudden they don't have the tools. And then they go into fight flight. And because drugs are so available now, once you find drugs, it's the perfect fight flight. And so they, at that age, got complex trauma in a very short period of time, but it sent them down the same road as everybody else. And what you have to understand is it doesn't matter when the complex trauma starts. Once you go into fight flight, it will take you down a road where they eventually you start to look like everybody else. You're doing the same stuff, behaving in the same ways, and you're ending up in the same place. When we started finding freedom, I said the first night, in case you think we're here to deal with addicts, everybody here is broken, just in varying degrees. We're all on a journey of healing. Okay, one other thing that I wanted to say about the complex trauma was this. One of the first clients I dealt with had a father, had a mother that blew up one time in her life, but she was only 4 years old. And that impacted her so much that every time after that, when her mom got the least little bit agitated, she got traumatized. So in her mind, it was an unsafe family. And so, but it was only one event that set in a series of a radar system that read trauma into any agitation in mom. And so that's part of what can happen. And so she ended up in addiction, severely, severe complex trauma stuff. But it started with only one traumatic event that she then, it changed in her mind. So those are the different kind of scenarios that you might deal with, and you kind of scratch your head at first. But then you begin to put the pieces together and see a pattern that came out of that. Okay, I want to get into the 50 characteristics. I'm not sure how many we'll get into, but I want to briefly cover this. Hopefully what you see is that you don't just fix complex trauma using one thing. There's a whole bunch of variety of things. So let me just, before I get into this biopsychosocial spiritual, what is working right now, and that one of the most difficult parts is when a person gets triggered and they escalate in that nanosecond. So what are the tools to kind of pull that, to de-escalate, is the word that we use. So a healthy person has what we call distress tolerance. What complex trauma does is makes you stress intolerant. So you have to develop distress tolerance, and you have to be able to de-escalate when you're triggered. So there's two skills there. So what has come out is what is known widely now as grounding and mindfulness, or mindfulness and grounding. So the focus of grounding is when you get escalated, what will help you de-escalate so you get your thinking part of your brain working again and your emotions calmed. so you can think it through and make a wise decision. So grounding can be you go through the provinces of Canada, you touch something, you smell something, you say, I'm in this room, it's this day, this is my birthday, but it's anything that will bring you back to be in the present. Because trauma takes you either to the future or the past, and you go crazy in the present and don't know how to live there. So you're grounding yourself back to reality. So that's grounding all kinds of different ways. Everybody's got to find what way works best for them. What mindfulness is about is this. So picture you go to an anger management course, and the only thing the professor or teacher says is when your anger gets triggered, count to 10. And that's the only advice he gives. What he's given you is grounding. Count to 10. But what you know if you've got anger issues is count to 10 is a joke after a while, because you count to 10 and you're still ready to kill somebody. So what you realize, it's not just in the moment that you need tools. You need to be building yourself up in the rest of life. That's the mindfulness. So I need to be self-aware. What are my moods today? What stresses are in my life today? Where am I at as far as my relationships? Am I frustrated? Am I fulfilled? All of those things I need to be aware of. Am I spiritually fit? Am I emotionally fit? Am I physically taking care of myself? Am I getting enough sleep? All of those things. If I'm not getting healthier there, I can count to 10 till I'm blue in the face and it's not going to work. So it's grounding and mindfulness are what really are being taught. You might be interested, it goes by the term dialectical behavior therapy, which was designed for borderline personality people. Psychiatrists said there's no hope for borderlines because there's not a pill to give them. And so what came out was this dialectical behavior therapy. So what dialectical simply means is this. Complex trauma person has two powerful forces in their life pulling them in opposite directions. So when they're triggered, they want to kill somebody, but there's still a weak force to say, I want to be healthy. So they're going in two different directions. Sounds like Romans 7. The things I want to do, I don't. Things I don't want to do, I do. And so what it's saying is, how do you get a person who's divided or split back to oneness? You got to de-escalate them and get them healthier. So dialectical behavior therapy was developed for complex trauma, and it's the only thing that is helping people outside of kind of all of this deeper stuff that we're teaching. So healing, then, there is a biological piece. There's brain chemical stuff we need to know. There's physical body stuff we need to know. There is a cycle. There's mental health pieces. There's childhood stuff that needs to be explored to find out how I cope. There's the social, the support network of my life that has to be in there. And there's a spiritual. Now, this is where I think churches fail the most. Now, some of you, you're going to need to hear me carefully. Do you realize that there are 3% of people with addiction that can stop and never use again just because they are the most stubborn people in the world? And we call them dry drunks. They're miserable to live with, but they're sober. So they have this willpower that is just a stubbornness personified. That's not healthy, but 3% can do it. They don't need God. They don't need AA. They don't need treatment. Nothing.
Is that called a dry drink?
Dry drunk, yeah.
Dry drunk,
yeah. Okay, but here's what I want you to understand. Christians, because of what we do, we are drawn to the spiritual. And we tend to put all our eggs in the spiritual basket. And so a lot of addicts go to churches, and then the churches say, just pray more and read your Bible more, get involved in a fellowship group. And they're doing all these spiritual things, but nobody's working on their trauma. Nobody's helping them get healthy coping skills, and then they relapse, and the church says, oh, you must not have enough faith, you're not doing a good enough Christian, and they blame them. That's what dysfunctional families do. If you fail, it's your fault. It's not our fault. And so that is the danger. So I get more persecution from Christian churches than anybody else, because here's this. The greater the trauma, the greater a person is eventually going to have to find a spiritual solution. Okay? Okay, now here's where you got to hear me. Do you realize that 90% of addicts don't need Jesus to stay clean? So if I start saying you have to get Jesus, I'm lying. And that's my dilemma. If I'm going to have integrity, I can say most of you are going to need to find a spiritual thing, which is going to be a moral compass, is going to be things that help you build yourself up emotionally, feel connected, and become healthier. That's spiritual. You're going to need that. You're not going to make it without it. You might go into natural stuff. You might go into your native culture stuff. You might go into Buddhism. You might go into all kinds, AA with a higher power. All of that is a spiritual focus. Now, Christians say, well, that's not good enough. And I go, but you got to deal with that. So let me give you an example. If I was a pastor and we had a bunch of people with cancer and I wanted to start a cancer support group, I could talk about how important Jesus was because they're all Christians. Okay? But let's say we say, let's start a cancer program in the community to help people with cancer. If I went into a cancer program to the community and say, we are the authority on dealing with cancer, you just need Jesus and Christian friends. I'm lying now. I'm saying you need surgery. You need some real changes here. And so the danger we have is to put all our eggs in the spiritual basket, get it all out of balance, say it's way more important than it is, and then drive people away. So let me take that further, because this is where it gets scary.
Say it again. It's like the part where you went to...
Cancer?
From cancer.
Okay. So let me add the next, and then I'll try to tie it all together, okay? So the bottom line that I'm coming at is the challenge for the church is 90% of addicts can stay clean and get healthy without becoming a Christian, okay? But we want them to become a Christian. Our thing, go into all the world, we want to evangelize, that's part of it. So we get really torn because we want them to become a Christian, and so we try to make it more important than it really is. And that can do damage. So here's the challenge for me. We started Finding Freedom as a support group to Christians addicts, and I taught from the Bible, etc. But what I began to realize is they were bringing their friends who weren't Christians. They'd come once or twice and not come again. And I go, start asking why. Well, you're too, don't want to hear all this Bible stuff. It's too Christian. And so I did a lot of thinking, and I said, you know what? They've been so wounded by the church. I had a woman come into me, say, I hate God. And I say, tell me about this God that you hate. She started describing, I said, I hate him too. She said, what? I thought you were a pastor. Yeah, I hate that God. I think we need to discover the right God here. Yeah. But they assume that because we're using God, we're going by the same definition they are. And so that has to get clarified. But what happened was, I said, okay, these people have been hurt by church, turned off by church. Many have been sexually abused within churches, all kinds of things like that. They've been in Christian homes growing up where they were physically, sexually abused. It was terrible. And they are not going to come to anything that smells Christian. So what I decided to do, I said, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to start a second Finding Freedom that is zero Christianity. I'm going to teach the science of addiction and complex trauma and build relationships. You want to know what's happened? Hundreds have become Christians. Because as you build the relationship, they start to trust you. And then they start to say, I want some of that. And before you know it, they're coming to Christ. So here's the tricky thing. To do evangelism, I had to go to the other extreme and not evangelize at all. That seems like a contradiction. But I think that's the challenge. So everybody, all churches want to start addiction stuff, and then they end up driving everybody away. But they feel quite proud of themselves because they're doing an addiction program. They're just doing it with their agenda. So here's something you have to understand about complex trauma. Families of complex trauma do not know how to love people. They only know how to use people. So everybody in a complex trauma family has an agenda of how to get their needs met. And so they always have a hidden agenda. So I always tell this story. I say to the clients, how many of you have had a friend say, would you mind just dropping me off at the next corner? I need to go to the grocery store. And then you get to the next corner and they go, would you wait 5 minutes and then take me here? And then you say, okay. And you take them there. Would you wait 5 more minutes? And then before you know it, you're taxing them all around the city. Hidden agendas. That's all they know how to operate by. Guess what their antenna, their radar is set for when they come into a church? Hidden agendas. Do these people love me because they got an agenda? They want me to do what they're doing? Or do they love me with zero agenda? And until we're able to love with zero agenda, we will not reach the very people.
That is the love of Christ.
Exactly. But that's what churches have twisted.
That's the love of Christ, but not the love of man.
Exactly. Yeah. And so complex trauma people are hypersensitive to hidden agendas, and churches are famous for hidden agendas. And that's what makes this ministry, and why I got so much opposition from churches, is because I refuse to have that hidden agenda. But yet God's blessed it. And that's, to me, what is important.
How does the church have a hidden agenda, or what is it?
Hidden agenda. You're going to come in, and I'm going to love you. And I'm going to be nice to you, but I want you to become a Christian. That's my agenda. That's what they're supposed to do.
They think you're being Christian.
That's being a faithful Christian to the Great Commission.
It's kind of conditional, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a proselytizing is the word. You're making followers of Jesus. That's the ultimate hidden agenda. So we're going to do an addiction ministry to bring all these non-Christians in so we can get them converted. That's the agenda.
Doesn't that make you feel good? That's the only reason.
Exactly. Exactly.
Examples where I don't put Alpha on a pedestal and I don't put the treatment center worked on a pedestal.
Right.
Right? But ironically, some of the most God talks and faith and people do well are the people that were saying some of the illest things about God and whatnot.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it was hard for me, I can do other people's inventory, but just like, oh no, you're wrong, and let me tell you.
Yep.
When we come alongside people and let them have their process and they're earnestly, like even the, I'm a big fan of the AA.
Yep.
Big book, and it says, if you are earnestly seeking,
more
will get revealed.
Exactly.
And so I've seen some people like, no, it's a mountain and whatnot. And I've seen some Christians who meant well, they don't need to demonize that, either go, that's not God, that's whatever. And it's just their security, their judgment to God, and they lost them. And so I don't have it all together, but I thank God that because I had so much shame and like, where did I go wrong? And that's where I think AA gets it right.
Yep.
Is that we're going to do well at being open and letting people be curious. And it's not for us to say it's right or wrong.
Yep.
And then I've seen lots of men and women, including myself, go, you know what? Now it's about, I want to be an anchor.
When I was at the secular treatment center for 13 years, I made a commitment to the boss up front. I would never introduce any God-Christian discussions. And on a weekly basis, clients would sneak into my office. Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question? So I'm odd to begin with, and I know that. But that's, God uses odd ducks, and that's important. But if I'm with a group of people, I would rather sit and talk to a group of addicts any day over a group of normal Christians, because I know the conversation will get more real and go deeper. And be often more spiritual than I would get with kind of Bible cliche type of discussions. So that we could go for a long time on those rants. But okay, let me take you to the next one. Just something that might help you understand what you're looking at when you're dealing with an addict. And I find clients get tremendously helped by this because I say you have five people inside of you. Doesn't mean you have multiple personalities. It just, you got five people. So here they are. There's the addict you. So you could be living today nicely, but you get triggered to use and you use. The addict comes out of the closet. And it's like a monster that wants to be fed. And your behavior changes, your thinking changes, everything. You're angrier, you're more selfish, you're more dishonest. So you got that addict you that's always there, will always be there for the rest of your life. If you don't feed it, it won't come out. But if you trigger it, it will come out. And you change totally. Then you got the traumatized you. Fear gets triggered in any way. Fear of rejection, fear of the unknown, fear of change, fear of getting hurt, fear of failure. Any fear, a different you comes out. You get that massive escalation nanosecond. You go into crazy land and you're a different person. That person's always there. It'll be there the rest of your life. It will get triggered. Your triggers might not come as frequently as you grow, but it will always be there. Third one, you have a mental health. anxiety issues, depression issues, OCD issues. That is always going to be there. Medication can help, but there's a therapeutic, a counseling thing. But when you can be doing well, but depression hits you, you want to isolate. You don't want to be with people. You don't feel like doing anything. You just want to sleep all day or not sleep at all. Eat all day or not eat at all. A different person comes out. They're inside of you too. And you don't always know when you're going to get triggered. Then you got that little child. So that five-year-old that stopped growing, that never got the love, the nurture, the training, the comfort. And there, that little child is there. Now, what's important for people to understand is the addict hates that little child. Because that little child was weak. They cried. That's weakness. That's what makes you vulnerable to get picked on. That little child had fear. That's weak. And so they take all of their emotions, and it's like they take a part of themselves and they stick it in a closet and lock the door. I hate that part of me. And that's that little child. And so that child is still there. And that child, when it's triggered, I don't know if you've ever talked with people who are addicts, but sometimes they're in a situation you just see like they're a little boy standing in front of you. They're a deer in the headlights. They're just so helpless looking. That's the little child coming out. Sometimes the little child comes out to play. And they're silly and they're teasing inappropriately and all of that kind of stuff. And you want to smack them because they're annoying you. But that's the little child that doesn't know how to be mature. Okay? And then you get the adult. That's the cerebral cortex that's wise. Guess which is the weakest of those five? The last one. So recovery is one weak adult fighting four powerful things that are opposite. And so what you have to learn in recovery, and it's part of the bio, psychosocial, spiritual, is you have to learn to manage the addict you. You got to learn relapse warning signs. You got to learn how to handle relapse triggers. You got to go to meetings and do all of those support things. You got to manage that. Then you got to learn how to manage the traumatized you, mindfulness and grounding. Then you got to learn to manage the mental health you, getting medical help, dealing with all of your mental health things. So think of it this way. If you got anxiety or depression, they pull you powerfully in one direction, negative. So what happens with depression, anxiety? I want to isolate. I don't want to be responsible. I don't want to engage with people. All negative pulls. You got to learn to manage that. You got to learn to do what you don't feel like doing. And your limbic brain doesn't like that. Okay? Next thing. Addict brain stimulates the limbic. Traumatized, limbic. Mental health, limbic. Child, limbic. Where's the only cortex? The adult. So you got a little wee cortex fighting against a great big limbic. And you're trying to learn to manage all of that. So that is the challenge that they face in healing and moving forward. Okay.